This is WGBB AM 1240 and W240 DFFM 95.9 Freeport, New York.
The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from the WGBB studios in Merrick, New York, this is Sports Talk New York.
Good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome. Welcome to Sports Talk New York on WGBB in Merrick, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue here, taking you through the first hour on this Sunday, the 26th day of October, 2025. With us tonight, guiding us through the evening, is our engineer, Brian Graves. Glad to have you with us, that you've taken the time to join us tonight. Up first, we'll welcome back to the show the legend, the icon himself, Jerry Eisenberg. I just lost my script. Hang on, folks. 1 second. There we go. Jerry has a book out titled Once They Were Giants, The Golden Age of Heavyweight Boxing. We'll discuss this great era with Jerry, and in the second half, we will welcome in author Jim Leake, who's written a book, The Big Loosh, The Unruly Life of Umpire Ron Luciano, or as I used to call him, Ron Luciano. But we will talk about that gentleman who, at his best, I will describe as colorful. So we'll leave it at that for now. So relax, enjoy the show tonight. We got some great sports talk waiting for you, and I'm excited to share it with you tonight. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow me on my Facebook page. It's called The Talk of New York Sports. You'll find sports information, show information, great photos. Stop by, give it a look. You can also follow me on X at B. Donahue, WGBB, all one word. And if you miss a show, don't worry. They're all out on the website the next day at www.sportstalknewyork.com. You can catch up anytime. Well, our first guest, a sports journalist, to say the least, with the Newark Star-Ledger. He was born in Newark, New Jersey, and in 1997, he was inducted into the Sports Hall of Fame of Jersey. In 2000, he won the Red Smith Award from the Associated Press Sports Editors. He was a 2000 inductee of the National Sportscasters and Sports Writers Association Hall of Fame. And in 2016, he was inducted into the Boxing Hall of Fame. One more Hall of Fame, the New Jersey Hall of Fame. So to call Jerry a Hall of Famer, you can say the least. That is what you can call him. His book is titled Once There Were Giants, The Golden Age of Heavyweight Boxing. I'd like to welcome back to the show tonight Jerry Eisenberg. Jerry, good evening.
Well, good evening. I didn't recognize me from that introduction.
Yeah, that's you. That's
you
for sure.
Too kind.
No worries.
Oh, don't overrate me. I'm only an 18 horse of fame.
Oh, yeah, that's all. And, Jerry, you came from a baseball-centric family. How did you become a boxing fan?
They told me to go cover fights.
Okay.
And that's how I learned. You know, I worked at the Star-Ledger. Well, I've been in this business 74 years.
Right.
I'm 95 now.
Mm-hmm.
For a brief time, I was with the New York Herald Tribune, a brief and very productive time. Everything I learned there. And that was a three-year period. And Jesse Abramson was the general assignment guy there. And he was so good that Stanley Woodward, the editor, sent him to everything. And finally he said, Stanley, you're breaking me down. You got to give me some help. The kid we just hired, let's make him the club fight guy so I don't have to go do them, and then I'll break him in on the big fights.
Uh-huh.
And that's exactly how I learned.
Okay. Yeah, great story. Now, in the book, of all the events chronicled in the book, we're coming up to the anniversary, October 30th, 1974, of the Rumble in the Jungle. The kids may not be familiar with that. Let's talk a little bit about the Rumble in the Jungle.
Well, that I went to that fight because Ali and I had become friendly anyway, but I had met Ali at the Olympics. And I didn't meet him there, actually. I saw him there. He was a light heavyweight. You don't go to light heavyweight fights at the Olympics because they have about the authority of today the Apache Rain Dance King. I mean, you don't make any money. They don't, and then you figure they either move up to be heavyweights or you forget they were here. So he wins a gold medal, and he's sitting on the steps in the Olympic Village in Barcelona. It might have been Rome. It was Rome, 1960. And people are walking by, and half of them don't speak English. Mm-hmm. And he's screaming, I'll be a champion, I'll be the heavyweight champion, I'll be the best. The one thing I noticed was when the female athletes walked by, they went about 5 feet, they stopped, they turned around, came back another 2 feet and took a good look at him. So I said, if for no other reason, I'm going to pay attention to this guy. He wanted me to go to his fights. I saw no purpose. I mean, he was fighting streetcar conductors, and for all the talent they had early.
Right.
Anyway, he calls me up from Pittsburgh, and he said, I'm fighting a killer tomorrow night. I want you to come out here. Well, it was Angelo Dundee that gave him my phone number. And I said, I don't like to go to Pittsburgh to stop for gas. I ain't coming out to see you fight a retired pro football player who maybe he can spell fight, but he sure as hell can't do it. But he kept after me. And finally I said, all right, I'll go see him. I went to see him against Doug Jones, an overstuffed light heavyweight and a good fighter. I thought Jones won the fight. And so apparently did the people behind Ali, because they were set to fight Liston, but they couldn't make the match because there was so much controversy about the Jones decision.
Mm-hmm.
So they took him to England to fight Henry Cooper. Henry Cooper is a guy who could knock down a wall with his left hook and could bleed to death with a high cheekbones. He just could. I always wanted to make a fight between him and Chuck Wepner. I wanted the plasma concession, and I wanted to have it going in. But he knocked Henry out, and the rest is history. I was there when he beat Liston both times, and then when he fought, then he lost the fight. Of course, he lost to Frazier, and he lost that fight to Frazier no matter what he says, no matter what he did. But listen, he was gone for 2.5 years before that, and then they gave him to fight Jerry Quarry, a pretty good fighter. And after that, he had to fight Oscar Bonavina, who could punch so hard he almost knocked Joe Frazier out of the ring earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But he wins them both, and now he's going to fight Frazier, and he loses the fight, clearly loses the fight. And so he takes the long way back because Frazier has been knocked out by George Foreman, who is the new champion. He's got to get to Foreman. He fights Frazier again, but I'll tell you, that Ali Frazier, number two, was so bad if it hadn't been the names Frazier and Ali, I would have walked out. There's nothing.
Yeah.
So Ali keeps winning and winning and winning, and finally they make the fight in Africa. So I go there, and I had a pretty good relationship with both fighters. It was a pleasure. I wrote what I saw, I wrote what I knew, and when he went to the corner in the lope-a-dope, there is no lope-a-dope, there is no such thing. He got hurt in the first round. He said, this guy, and he told me, he said, this guy really hits hard. So he went to the corner, put his gloves up so he could figure out what to do. Well, after 2 rounds of that, he looked at George's arms. Each one weighed a half a ton. He said, let him do that all night, and then I'll take care of it when his arms get too heavy. He goes to the corner in his own corner and says, get off the damn ropes. And he says, mind your own damn business. I know what I'm doing.
Uh-huh.
And he did.
Yeah.
And finally, I think it was the eighth round, I'm not sure, eighth or ninth, he knocked him out. and now we had a new champion. After that particular fight, I was with Dave Anderson from the New York Times, the late Dave Anderson, great writer, great guy. And I said to him, you know, it happened so quickly, and we had to get on a satellite to send our stories. We had very little time. I said, I got to do a better job. And Dave said, I had the same problem. I said, let's go look for him. We was living on a military compound, about maybe it was 100 miles long and wide. And Dave says, where are you going to find him? I said, I know where he'll be if he's outside. He saw a certain mysticism in the Congo River in his mind. Let's go to the river. I think he'll be down there. Mm-hmm. We go to the river, and he is. And he's at the water's edge. He doesn't know we're there. So it's not a performance, because he always performed, but he did not have eyes in the back of his head, although sometimes I thought he did. So he's standing at the river's edge, yelling across the French, what used to be French Congo, screaming, and you can see his head, but we can't hear him. Suddenly he takes both arms, shoots them up in the air in the Rocky pose, and then turns and sees us. And he says, fellas, don't ask me how I feel about this, because I couldn't tell you, and if I could, you wouldn't understand it. But I always thought to myself, when he stood there with his back to us, not performing for anybody, but doing what he felt in his heart, arms raised in the air, in that moment, he was the king of the world. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, he came back. He fought in Malaysia against Joe Bugner, and now they made the Frazier fight. Well, he wasn't supposed to fight anymore. You know, he retired like 32 times.
Yeah.
So he calls a press conference and retires. You can write that. I'm letting the other guys beat each other on the head. I'm not taking them. And we knew it was BS, but we had to write it. So we wrote it. Now, Dave and I are walking down the hall. His door is open, alley. And I hear this yelling. He can't fight. He's an old man. He can't fight. I'll knock him cold. The door is open, and he's trolling for an audience. So he invites us in. And Joe Frazier's previous fight is on the screen in his room, and he goes through the same routine. So I said, but you retired an hour ago. He said, yeah, but I got to fight this guy. People are going to want this fighter. So we had to go back and tear up our stories and rewrite and write another story about how he was going to fight Frazier. That's how we got the story that he was going to fight Frazier. Mm-hmm. The fight didn't seem like much to me or anybody else.
Right.
I used to kid Frazier. I used to call him on the phone. Frazier was a one-armed fighter. Left hook, left hook, left hook. I said, if your right shoe becomes untied, champ, call me and I'll tie your shoe for you, because you don't have a right hand at all.
Yeah.
They hired George Benton, a great, great middleweight. Had he been white, he'd have been a champion. And Eddie Futch, the trainer and Swayze manager, said, you got one job. You don't train him for stamina. You don't run with him. You got one job. You got to teach him to throw a right hand. Because Ali's boxing, it ain't going to be a good one. It ain't going to be a hard one. But you got to teach him. Because if Ali sees that, his boxing IQ is so great, he'll pause and say, is this something I have to deal with? That's how the fight became close. He almost knocked Ali out in the first round. I'm sorry, you got it reversed. He almost got knocked out in the first round. Mm-hmm. But around the third or fourth, he hits Ali with a right hand. And Ali screams, you can't do that. You can't learn a right. You got no right hand. You're an old man. You can't. And Frazier yells back, asked George Benton, and he cracks him again with a right hand.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, Frazier's in the fight. And the fight looked like a Wall Street graph, up and down. One guy's ahead, then the other guy's ahead, and then it goes back to the first guy. And to me, it's life and death coming down to the end. Now, we're in about, this was a 15-round fight. It only went 14, but it was supposed to be 15. Mm-hmm. We're coming down near the end, like the 12th, 13th round. Frazier's arms are hanging down. His legs are quivering like wet spaghetti. Ali only has to walk 1 foot and push him, and the fight is over. Ali could not walk that 1 foot. That's how much these guys put into this fight. At the end of round 14, Ali didn't want to go out there anymore, and Frazier really couldn't win. I mean, his eyes were closed. It was hard. Mm-hmm. Butch says to Benton, cut his gloves off. Joe says, if you do that, I'll kill the both of you. I'll kill the both of you. I want this 15th round. I'm going to knock him out. He said, son, your eyesight means more to me than some hunky-junk piece of hardware they're going to give you.
Yeah.
They cut the gloves off. When they cut the gloves off, the other corner spotted it, and they're yelling at Ali. Ali was very, very grateful. He'd have had trouble going at himself. He sinks to the floor after the decision. The story was he didn't want to get run over by the people jumping in the ring. Well, not so. They both left everything they had on the floor. Now they're coming back up. I don't see Frazier again that night. He's going the other way to stretching room. Ali is being helped up the steps. He sees Anderson. Amico knows us both well. He leans in and he says, that's the closest you will ever see to death.
Wow.
And I said to Dave, I don't want to see anything any closer, because then I'll be dead myself.
Yeah.
In the 12th, 13th round, I said, well, they both won, send them home. Now I got a problem. The fight is over. We had like a 13, 14-hour difference in time. I got 20 minutes to write a column. That's not a fight story. That's a column of opinion, and I got only 20 minutes. And I will never forget it. I don't like to quote myself, but this will tell you what kind of fight it was. I said, Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier did not fight last night here in Manila for the WBC heavyweight championship. Nor did they fight for the championship of the planet. They fought for the championship of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I'm concerned, that will never be settled.
Yeah.
It was a fight. It would have been the second best fight I ever saw in my life if my camel hadn't died on the way to the Cain and Abel fight. People say, what fight was your first? And that would have been it.
Yeah.
But the camel was dead. I got there late. There was a guy laying on the ground dead, and the other guy had a mark on his forehead. That's as close as I came to. That's the only fight I could consider putting ahead of the effort those two guys put out that night.
That is amazing. We are speaking with the sports writing legend Jerry Eisenberg tonight on Sports Talk New York. Now, I want to go to a different fight. Two completely different guys, Jerry. Larry Holmes, Ken Norton. I believe this one to be one of the greatest fights of all time. 15 rounds, and those guys left it all out there too, didn't they?
Well, they did, but I'll tell you, what made it people don't know this. Holmes tore a muscle in his bicep. I don't remember his left or right arm. And I helped him get together with a trainer, a physical therapist who I had to go to later on as I got older. The guy is no longer with us. Heath Clevin. He wrote the book on physical therapy. And he told Holmes, I can fix it so you can fight without using any drugs. But if you get hit in that arm during a fight, you can't use it anymore.
Wow. Yeah.
So he's ahead in the fight. He gets hit in that arm. He stops throwing that hand. But when they get to the 15th, miracle of miracles, one of the few times when my scorecard totally matches the judges, it's a draw going into the 15th round. And at the start of the round, Norton, who could punch, hits Holmes, and Holmes staggers. And then Holmes says, to hell with it. And he starts to throw that arm. And before the round is over, Norton is in danger of being knocked out. They both survive, but what a 15. That's the best single heavyweight round, that round. because there were reasons for the fight being close that had nothing to do with their particular skills. It was the arm. But that round was the best single heavyweight round I ever saw. Interesting enough, Allie Frazier was the best heavyweight fight I ever saw. There wasn't a knockdown in either one. And in the Frazier fight, there wasn't a clinch. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to tell you why. The Frazier people didn't want the same guy to referee it that refereed the Lumber in the Jungle. Because referees have styles. His style was to let a guy fight from the outside. I mean, Frazier had a fight inside, as you know. He was more or less a one-arm fighter. They had a candidate. So they agree. They will protest the commission. No Filipino is big enough and strong enough to pull them apart. So we don't want a Filipino. And then they would go make their own individual case. Well, the word got out. I'm going to go to the rules meeting where nothing ever happens, but something's going to happen here. I know it. Mm-hmm. In comes a Filipino army colonel with a gun that looks like it's from his shoulder to the floor. It was a .45, really. He puts it on the table and says, I understand there's a debate here. He points to the gun and says, there is no debate. A Filipino will referee this fight. Well, he wasn't going to get any. Once he pointed to the gun, neither guy was going to argue about that.
Right.
Now, he says, you should meet him. And he brings him in. In the room walks the biggest, strongest Filipino I have ever seen this side of Roman Gabriel. And he had no trouble at all. He worked a perfect fight with the two guys who were the hardest to control. In the beginning, Allie was not the all-American boy. He had a habit. He put his glove behind your head, pull your head down, and hit you with an uppercut. The first time he did it, the referee said, uh-uh. Do that one more time, I'll throw you out of this ring.
Wow, yeah.
And then Frazier lost sight of the border and hit him below the belt. He knocked Frazier's hand away. He said, you do that again, I will stop this fight and throw you out. They never clinched. They could barely move by the end. It was an amazing fight. And this guy made it, and there were no knockdowns, but this guy made it a better fight. Because they fought and they fought and they fought. And I never saw anything like it in my life.
And that was the thrill in Manila, right, Jerry?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
I know when I came up there, there was a little Filipino, it might be redundant, no harm, no swear intended. He was in tails and a top hat, and he had a bullhorn. And he was standing in front of the hotel, and he was yelling into the bullhorn, I have spoken to the Lord. I spoke to God last night, and God has told me Joe Frazier will win this fight. And I was riding with Dave Anderson, and I said, hey, go up there and ask him if he'll give me 3-1 on that.
Yeah.
Everybody, the people who saw the fight were changed. Now, of the Americans who were there, I think I'm the only survivor.
Yeah. And what a night. What a night that was, as you depict there.
Hey, on that trip, I saw Marcus' wife's shoe room, the famous shoe room that had all those shoes in it. She had 1,000 shoes or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
It was an amazing week. It really was. But, you know, Chapter 6, I happen to know, in that book about the great era of heavyweight boxers, and the whole Chapter 6 is devoted to that fight, and the chapter is called The Night When Nobody Blinked.
Mm-hmm.
And earlier in the book, this book is a history of boxing, but it goes back to the speakeasy days when the mob first discovered boxing, and I knew all those mob guys. But they're all portrayed in this book, and I think it'll be a lesson to somebody. You know the thing about this book? the hardcover had a million typographical errors, and I was really angry. And it came out about 10, 12 years ago. And then they called me about 5 years ago and said, we want to do a paperback. And I said, over my dead body. You'll do it only if you edit this thing and get all the typos out of it. Was a woman edited this who had never seen a fight. And during the course of her editing, she said to me, well, what is the mafia anyway? And I thought, oh, boy, I'm in big trouble.
Exactly.
So they fixed it. And this book now, well, it's a little higher than that now, but on the bestseller list for all the boxing books that Amazon has ever had for about a month on the anniversary of this fight when I did all these interviews like the one we're doing, it was number 4 in all of boxing.
Yeah.
It's made an amazing comeback. And I made a few bucks off that.
Yeah. As Jerry said, it's been out for a while. The paperback version is out now. And I believe Fred told me Barnes & Noble, Amazon, you can get this great book. It's not so much, well, it is, of course, it is a boxing book. But to me, it's also an American history book. Like Jerry says, boxing goes back to the mob in the early days. He depicts that in the book, and so much more to get out of it. And Jerry, we have to quit now.
All right.
But I have so much more I want to talk about. Ali Liston, Jerry Cooney, and
well,
of course Roberto
I'll come
Clemente.
Out for the 15th round.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. We'll bring you back. I'll get in touch with Fred and we'll schedule it.
It'll be my pleasure.
All right. That's Jerry Eisenberg. An honor and a pleasure. I thank you, Jerry, for taking time out of your Sunday night to spend it with us back here in New York. Once again, folks, you will want to read Once There Were Giants, The Golden Era of Heavyweight Boxing. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, a tremendous read. And that's the great Jerry Eisenberg, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks again, Jerry.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was Jerry Eisenberg. Up next on Sports Talk New York, we'll welcome in author Jim Leake to talk about his new book on umpire Ron Luciano. Stick around, folks.
You're listening to Sports Talk New York. Tune in every Sunday night at 8 p.m. on Long Island's WGBB. Broadcasting on 95.9 FM and 1240 AM. Or listen live online at WGBBRadio.com. Stay connected to Sports Talk New York on WGBB by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at WGBB Sports Talk. You're listening to Sports Talk New York on Long Island's WGBB. And now, back to the show.
All right, folks, we're back. We're back at Sports Talk New York on WGBB AM/FM Radio live from beautiful downtown Merrick, Long Island. And the carnival is in town, Brian. Did you see that? I stopped and went on the Tilt-A-Whirl for a while. Yeah, I got sick on that. Had a little cotton candy, and I couldn't get my hands off the steering wheel when I got here. But I made it in time. The Fall Classic in full swing, guys. It's turning into a good one, I think. Series tied at one game apiece. The Stars are not disappointing thus far, and we're going to add some drama in the series Monday night with Max Scherzer taking the ball for Toronto. So I'm looking forward to that. And the big news is the Jets win. Stop the world. I want to get off. The Jets win 39-38 over the Bengals. Unbelievable, as the Jets are. The win, though, it's kind of bittersweet due to the news of the passing of their all-pro center, Nick Mangold. He was nice enough to come on the show with me a few years ago. He died of a kidney disease, and he was 41 years old, which is way too early for a guy like Nick to pass away. just a real sad situation. And we wish our best to the whole Jets family and, of course, to Nick's family, friends, and all the best to those guys. Nick Mangold, 41 years old. Well, our next guest, a former news journalist, retired copywriter and creative director, and a U.S. Navy veteran. He is the author of several books, including The Best Team Over There, Untold Story of Grover Cleveland Alexander, one of my favorite Hall of Famers, and The Great War. That's part of that book as well. From the Dugouts to the Trenches, Baseball During the Great War, which for the uninitiated is World War I, not II, I. Keep a good track of your wars, folks. And I'd like to welcome to the show tonight Jim Leak. Jim, good evening.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
Wonderful to have you aboard, Jim. I'd like to start off by asking you, what teams did you root for as a kid, players, teams, and who do you root for today?
Well, when I was growing up here in Ohio, I followed the old Indians more than the Reds. Mm-hmm. But my favorite player was Eddie Matthews, who I never saw.
Yeah.
And I wish I had. These days, I hate to say this to New Yorkers, but I'm following the Dodgers.
Okay. Yeah, no shame in that. A great ball club. Don't hurt yourself getting off the bandwagon, Jim, when they start going down. But, great, exciting baseball team. I've been a Mets fan my whole life, and I have the scars to prove it. Between the Mets and the Jets, Jim, I used to be a strapping young man. Healthy, and it turned me into what you see today, a broken person.
Sports will do that to you.
Yeah. So what made you want to write a book about Ron Luciano?
Well, you know, long ago when I was, I won't say a young reporter, but a youngish reporter, I actually met Ron Luciano. It was during his first book tour. I was working for the daily newspaper in Palo Alto, California, the long-lamented Peninsula Times Tribune, and I went up to San Francisco to interview him about his first book, The Empire Strikes Back, and it was at the St. Francis Hotel on Union Square in San Francisco, and I don't know where I ranked that day and the number of interviews he must have done.
Yeah.
I don't know. But he was great. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I wrote my story, a feature piece. And it was pretty much the same piece that everybody wrote because he was such a great subject. Then when he died 13 years later under very sad circumstances, I thought, yeah, I really didn't do a very good job, and most of my colleagues didn't do a very good job because we didn't dig behind the persona he created. So I made some notes, and all these years later, I decided to write his biography to see if I could actually understand him better and do a better job than I did the first time.
Yeah, he must have made an impact on you. Jim, that's for sure. I forgot to mention, folks, on the intro, the name of the book is The Big Loosh. It is the unruly life of umpire Ron Luciano. Now, Big Loosh, he pronounced his name Luciano. I always thought it was Luciano and most of the people that I've heard talk about him, but the name of the book is The Big Loosh for those looking for it. I just wanted to clear that up. Now, Jim, Luciano, he was born in Endicott, which for local folks, a suburb of Binghamton, right near the southern tier, the Pennsylvania border. He lived his entire life there, which is real interesting. The guy was 6'4", 260 pounds, and a tackle at SU, Syracuse University, and he majored in math. So there's an interesting fact right there, Jim.
Well, he was not only a tackle, he was an All-American tackle. He was a great football player.
And the fact that he majored in math is something that you wouldn't believe. He played on the Orangemen National Champion Squad one year with the Heisman Trophy winner Ernie Davis. And he was drafted.
Ernie Davis was a little later, but he did play with Jim Brown.
Ah, okay. We got mixed up there. Yeah, Jim Brown. And that's nothing to forget, folks, right there. That Ron Luciano and Jim Brown were on the same football team. He was drafted by the NFL.
He was. He was drafted by the Lions, but he never played a regular season game for them. He was hurt before the season started. He was called to play in the old college All-Star game. You know, the college stars played the NFL champions in a game every year, which, you know, is unimaginable today. And he got hurt in a scrimmage. He didn't play in the All-Star game and didn't play that season for the Lions. Next year he got hurt again. He still didn't play for the Lions. He signed later with Buffalo. Didn't play for them. He played minor league football. He played semi-pro football. He so loved being a football player. And it just never worked out. And really, to get back onto a playing field, any playing field, he became a baseball umpire.
Very interesting. Yeah. Now, he began in Class A, which was the Florida State League, promoted to Double A, to the Eastern League, and then Triple A, the International League. So he moved along rather quickly.
He did. He made very good progress. And he was finally called up to the American League. And he umpired in that league for 11 seasons.
Now, he played it pretty straight during his minor league career, didn't he?
He did. He was pretty much a regular umpire, though, you know, of course, better than most. But when he got into the majors, he found he really wasn't enjoying himself very much, and he took some advice just to loosen up and enjoy it more, be more of himself. And then he became the Ron Luciano everybody remembers.
Right, and he did indeed loosen up, Jim, as we know. He was known, folks, for his flamboyant calls. Particularly, he had a habit of shooting out players. Now, tell folks about that, Jim.
Yeah, when it was at first base, he wouldn't just call runners out. He would shoot them out with his, you know, his thumb and his forefinger. So, out, 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 out. The supposed total of how many times he shot a person on one call, ran as far as like 21 or 23. I don't think he actually did that many, but I'm sure it was in a dozen or more.
Well, I checked it, Jim. It's 16. Bill Haller, the umpire, counted it's 16 shots to one guy was the most he ever did.
he started with Amos Otis. And that became so popular that players were begging to be shot out instead of just called out at first
base. Yeah, the players really went along with it, and they enjoyed it.
They did. You know, Ronnie, I think of him as Ronnie. He was very popular with many of the players early on. Though some players, you know, disagreed with the whole outlandish nature of some of his calls, but a lot of the players really did enjoy it early on.
We are speaking with Jim Leake tonight on Sports Talk New York about his book, Big Loosh, about the life of the great umpire, Ron Luciano. Now, he used to do something else. He'd leap in the air, scream his calls, and the fans, of course, really dug it, and the league, of course, really hated it.
That's right. The fans loved it, the league hated it, and many of its colleagues, his fellow umpires, they hated it as well. And Ronnie was very popular with the men he worked with, but even some of them disagreed with it. But as you say, the fans ate it up, and The writers ate it up. So he got tremendous publicity while he was still an umpire.
And not only was his flamboyance recognized, Jim, but the Players Association, Players Association voted Ron Luciano one of two American League umpires to be rated excellent.
Right. Early on, he really was a fine umpire. The longer he worked the field, though, the more his enthusiasm slipped a little bit, and the more his maybe his skills slipped a little bit as well. And by the 11th season, I think he really had enough. So by that point, he was president of the Umpires Association. His whole appreciation of his job kind of changed later on.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Now, he also would stand what they called the National League way, between the pitcher and second base, which is what National League umpires did, instead of the American League umpires working behind second base. And, of course, the league didn't like that either.
The league didn't like a lot of what Ronnie did. Sometimes with justification, and sometimes just because they were very conservative and stuffy.
Right.
Which he wasn't at all.
No. He refused to call balks because he didn't understand the rule. So he
said nobody understood the rule.
Yeah. It's so vague. And he may be right because I see a balk and I don't get it. But, you know, umpires call it and everyone goes along with it. But Ron Luciano never called one because he didn't think anybody knew what the heck it was in the first place. Right, Jim?
Ronnie definitely had his own mind made up about quite a number of things.
Yeah. And there was one time I read, it was during spring training, so it probably was accepted a little bit more. He switched positions and had hats with Buddy Bell. He played part of an inning at third base while Buddy Bell umpired. And, of course, both were reprimanded by the league.
Well, I really hate to tell you that story is not true.
Okay, yeah.
There are a number of things that the man either said or wrote that I call in the book Luciano lore. They made great stories, but suddenly they were either exaggerated or made up. And really, sometimes I don't know that he knew he was making them up. But he was one of nature's great storytellers, a natural entertainer, and sometimes he just got carried away.
That's not to say he was a liar
or a con man. He was just Ronnie being Ronnie.
Right. Yeah, that's the case. And there's another one I'm going to bring up that may or may not be true. It was from Luciano's first memoir, and he talks about an incident involving Carl Yastrzemski. Now, Yaz comes to bat in Boston in 1976. Before he could say anything, before Luciano could talk to him, because he liked to chat with the batters, Carl Yastrzemski looks right at Luciano and says, "Listen, Ronnie, my kid's hitting 300. My wife is fine. I haven't heard any new jokes. I don't want to know about Polish restaurants. I'm nothing for 15. And I want you to keep your mouth shut." So Luciano says, "What could I say?" On the second pitch, he hits a home run, and Yaz, as he crosses home plate, looks right at Luciano and says, "Okay, you can talk to me now."
Yeah, that one I can't confirm specifically, but I totally believe it.
Yeah. And how about the story, Jim Leake, talking to us tonight about the legendary Ron Luciano? He admitted, but as you say, it might be a little embellished, on bad days following good nights, which means he had a good night the night before, but the following day he was hurting a little bit. And he would sometimes allow catchers that he trusted, guys like Elrod Hendricks, Eddie Herman, Johnny Roseborough. He allowed them to umpire for him. What about that?
Well, you know, I don't know specifically about that. That could be Luciano Lure. That could have some measure of truth. I don't know, and after all this time, I don't know that anybody can find out, really. But it sounds like him. You can't discount the possibility, but who knows?
Yeah.
That was one of the real challenges of writing his biography, was sorting out what was literally true from what was partially true from what was invented.
Yes.
It was a very challenging subject, believe me.
It's sort of like Jay Peterman on Seinfeld writing his biography, buying stories from Kramer to put in his book, you know, to make him sound a little more interesting. That may be what Luciano did in his book, The Umpire Strikes Back. There's a story.
You know,
go ahead, Jim. I'm sorry.
One of the stories in the book, I think it was from David Fisher, his co-author later, they were at spring training, and somebody was asking Lenny what he did over the winter, and what he had done was, what he always did was go hunting and fishing. But the fellow, I forget which player it was, but kept asking questions, so Lenny kept, you know, answering, and by the time he was done, he had bought a diner on the New Jersey Turnpike.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't remotely true, but it was much more interesting than saying, I just went hunting and fishing.
Yeah, why not? Vince Lombardi rest area. But he was the home plate umpire for Nolan Ryan's second no-hitter. Was that right, Jim?
He was, yeah. He was the home plate umpire for a number of the games because he was in the league for 11 years, and he thoroughly enjoyed it. He enjoyed a great performance, and he enjoyed it as much as the fans did.
Now, one thing we got to see that is legendary was Ron Luciano's feud with Earl Weaver, and it was a long-running feud. And their careers paralleled each other pretty much. They first met in AA, so they went way back together. And talk a little bit about the relationship between Luciano and the Hall of Famer Earl Weaver, Jim.
Yeah, there's a lot of a legend around it, and a lot of it that isn't true or is exaggerated. But what is true is they really didn't like each other.
Right.
That feud was not made up. It wasn't exaggerated. They really did not like each other. And each one got the other one in difficulty at least once. Randy said things he shouldn't have said and got reprimanded. Earl Weaver said things that he shouldn't have said and got himself suspended. It just went on and on. And one point, Ronnie threw Earl out of both ends of a doubleheader.
Yeah.
So, they did not get on at all.
There was a rumor that the Orioles placed bets on which inning Earl would get tossed by Ron Luciano.
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt that at all.
Yeah, and he publicly questioned Luciano's integrity. That's what got him the suspension, Jim. I found that. It was the...
That's right. That was
the third
was
inning.
That a game in... Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, it was the third inning of Luciano's first Orioles game on August 26, 1979 at Comiskey Park. He ejected Weaver, who in turn publicly questioned Luciano's integrity, and hence Earl received a 3-game suspension.
Right. Earl asked that it be announced, that that's why he was protesting the game. And it was. And Ron went along with it because he knew what was going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like so, you say, that they genuinely did not like each other. Like Luciano was said to have commented that you have an argument with an with a manager, you could still probably go out with him and have a beer after the game. Not so with Earl. No, they would not be able to do that.
They did not socialize. So interestingly enough, when Ronnie became a sportscaster for two seasons for NBC, he did interview Earl Weaver, who was still managing, and they got through it okay.
Yeah, but Luciano was said to have also commented, "It's impossible for me not to admire him, but it's pretty hard for me to like him."
Well, I don't think he was the only one who felt that way.
Yeah. Now let's talk about Ron Luciano's personal life. He was divorced. He was an amateur ornithologist, which I read, and he liked to read.
He did, yeah. He was a bird watcher. He was an avid reader. He loved Shakespeare. He used to say that he had the heaviest suitcase of all the empires because of all the bird guides and Shakespeare volumes.
Yeah.
And he was quite a bright guy, and some people thought he was even brilliant. He wasn't at all the big, amiable goof that he portrayed himself.
No, and he did go on for a couple of seasons with NBC's Game of the Week, which, as we know, was the only opportunity we had back then to see other teams and other ball players from other markets on the NBC Game of the Week on Saturday afternoon. And Ron took part in that as well.
He did. He was on the alternate Game of the Week with Merle Harmon. Yeah, and he did pretty well the first season, less well the second, and NBC didn't pick up his option for the third. But by that time, he was already starting on his books, so he made this seamless transition into best-selling author in the early 80s.
Yeah, people may not realize, Jim, he wrote 5 books on his reminiscences about his umpiring days.
He did, and they were enormously popular. I mean, I get people all the time telling me how they loved those books, when they were growing up or whatever. You can still find them. And in fact, the first one, I think, was recently republished. So, yeah, they were enormously popular at the time.
Entertaining for a lot of folks, and of course that made him a popular speaker on the banquet circuit, which he participated in. Now, I don't know if this is true or not, Jim. You let me know. He auditioned for the role of coach on Cheers. Is that true?
That is true, yeah.
Wow.
It's one of those things that sounds like it isn't true, but it actually is.
Yeah.
He didn't get the role. My theory always has been that he looked too much like George Wendt. He got the role of Norm.
Yeah, that could be. For people uninitiated and the kids out there, there was a real big hit TV show, Cheers, which always took place in a bar in Boston. And Coach was, I believe he was the first owner of Cheers, a former manager, I believe, of the Boston Red Sox. Coach Ernie Pantuso was the character's name. But the producers wanted an experienced actor, so they did not hire Ron Luciano for that role. The part went to Nicholas Colasanto, who later passed away. But that's an interesting story that Ron Luciano was up for that part. I think that would have been tremendous, don't you, Jim?
I think he would have been great, yes, I really do. But the role of Coach, the actor, was so great in it. You can't really say that they went wrong in the casting.
No, a lot of these characters chosen for hit sitcoms, you can't imagine somebody else in the role. These guys do such a tremendous job with the sitcoms during that era. We're speaking with Jim Leet tonight on Sports Talk New York about the life of Ron Luciano and Jim's new book. It's not brand new, but it's been out for a while and receiving accolades. I just want you to tell us, Jim, what award you guys are up for recently.
Well, I just heard the other day that it's up for the Casey Award for the best baseball book of 2025. And I'm so honored to be on that list because the authors who are finalists are just tremendous. So, yeah, it's an honor to be nominated. It's actually true.
That really is. And in the few seconds that we have left, Jim, I want you to talk about the death of Ron Luciano and the real tragedy, how he left us.
Yes. Ronnie really did hide behind that jovial persona he created in the last years of his life. Things gradually darkened for him, and he took his own life when a rose from the tailpipe of his car into the driver's seat and took his own life. And everybody who knew him, everybody, period, was shocked. Yeah. They had no idea that things had gone that far. I mean, his closest friends knew he was struggling, but nobody had any idea he had reached that dire point. It was terribly sad, and it was so at odds with what everybody thought they knew about him that it was a huge news, and people still shake their heads.
Yeah, I can imagine. As we said, so unlike the persona that he portrayed to us during his life. Well, Jim Leek, it's been a pleasure. I thank you for taking time out of your Sunday night to spend some of it with us here at Sports Talk New York. Again, folks, the book is titled Big Loosh, The Unruly Life of Umpire Ron Luciano. Thanks for being with us, Jim.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.
That's Jim Leek, ladies and gentlemen. That'll do it for me tonight on Sports Talk New York. I'd like to thank my guests, Jerry Eisenberg and Jim Leek, my engineer, Brian Graves, and, of course, you guys for joining us. I'll see you next week, next Sunday, November 2nd, for more Sports Talk New York. Till then, be safe, be well. Bill Donahue wishing you a good evening, folks.
The views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.